Welcome to the Divorce Podcast, where we explore all aspects of ending relationships, separation, and parenting apart. If your marriage or partnership has ended, or you have friends and family who are separating, this podcast is for you. I'm Kate Daly, a relationship counsellor, divorce specialist, and co-founder of Amicable, the online legal service for separating couples. In each episode, we look at relationships and separation from different angles, including the emotional, legal, and social. I'm joined by experts and special guests who share their own unique stories, experience, and tips with the goal of helping people end relationships in a kinder and better way. In this episode, I was joined by Julie Cooper, a clinical therapist, to talk about co-parenting at different ages and stages. Julie is the lead provider of mental health services at Honey for Mums. She's a co-parenting specialist and single mum of two, dedicating her career to helping parents in their co-parenting journey. This episode focuses on navigating the different stages of co-parenting, from separating with a baby through to toddlers, young children, and teens. The episode is packed full of tips about which living arrangements work best for different aged children and explores some of the common pitfalls of separating with young families. If you loved this episode, then please subscribe and rate us on your preferred listening platform. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's really lovely to see you. Now, before we get started and get stuck in, because I'm really interested to hear your story and some of your tips for co-parenting, we're doing a new thing, which is asking people for their separation song. So when you were going through your divorce or separation, or now, what is your separation song?
Yeah, so I would say It's Time to Go by Taylor Swift, which is not a super popular song. it was kind of a hidden track, I think, or a bonus track. And I didn't find it until probably about 3 years ago. And so kind of at the time of my divorce, I didn't have that song as kind of my separation song. But as time has gone on, I have really connected with it. I think it's a beautiful song. And it's kind of a tribute to choosing yourself and kind of removing yourself from a situation that is no longer serving you or is harmful to you. So I think it's just a beautiful song.
It sounds perfect. I'm going to look that one up when we finish. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
So this episode's all about co-parenting, and specifically we're going to look and be asking you about the different ages and stages of how you co-parent children when they're, as I say, at different ages and stages. But just before we get into some of those tips and some of the meat of that, just tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into co-parenting and working with families.
Yeah, so most of my experience has been working with children prior to the last few years. So I've worked with children in different areas. So in schools, I've worked in residential treatment centers with kids, and kind of I really was passionate about child development and working with kids going through trauma. So most of my experience has been with children. I did do some family work off and on for a little while. I took a little bit of time off to raise my own kids and then got back into the field, specifically with children and families. And then when I went through my own separation and divorce, really struggled with not having a lot of support and not a lot of resources and not a lot of information. And I feel like I was pretty alone in that journey. And once I sort of came out the other side, I was like, I think that I want to make a shift in my career and really focus on how I can support specifically women, but co-parents in general, both co-parents, in kind of navigating that journey and sort of minimizing the amount of trauma that kids can experience in the process. So that's kind of where I am at this point. I've been with Honey for Moms for the last couple of years, and I conduct groups with co-parenting groups, single mom support groups, and I provide individual therapy and manage a team of therapists. So
that's brilliant. I mean, I really echo what you say there. It's really difficult, isn't it, to find the right resources, support, and tools.
Truly.
And, you know, there's quite a bit of stuff that's out there on parenting now, but nobody really talks about the change and the transition from being a parent when you're in a family where you've got two partners to being, you know, a solo parent or co-parents. And it is a different role, isn't it? It's not the same as just, you don't just carry on being parents because your relationship with the other parent has changed so fundamentally and sometimes so catastrophically. So
right,
I think it's a
truly
really under-resourced area. So I'm super excited that we've got an expert and that
thank
you're going to
you
talk to us about it today.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm going to start do it in chronological order, if I may. Let's start with really young children, so infants and babies. So let's talk a little bit about if you are a couple and you are separating and you've got, you know, a baby,
there's obviously different things. You don't have to tell them that you're divorcing because they're obviously pre-verbal, but are there other things that are more important to an infant than the traditional things we might hear or see on other sort of resources?
Sure. Yeah. I just kind of want to mention that the baby stage, I think is all stages when you're co-parenting and you're moving through separation and divorce are super challenging. I think the baby stage, just mentioning that, you know, if there's postpartum depression, if the mom is struggling with sort of some other, you know, issues and then separating on top of it, especially if it was like kind of a sudden thing, I think it's just, I just want to, for anyone listening, just kind of empathize with what they're going through and mention that it's an extremely difficult thing to navigate. I think we're kind of thrown into this moment of sort of needing to show up for our baby who needs us constantly, and then trying to navigate through the grief process and through the process of just really in our brains kind of understanding what our life is going to look like. I mean, it's very confusing. It's disillusionment. It's so many different things. And so I think when you have a baby and you're on all of the time, and there's really not that time and space for you to kind of process what's going on. And so I think that that's just really important to note. I think in terms of parenting and the co-parenting journey, I think first and foremost, you know, is to kind of understand, is it possible for the parents to remain close in the home and parenting together while they navigate through the separation process? And I think it's really important to note that the safety of the children and also each parent is obviously the first priority. So if it's safe for the parents to kind of be in the same specific area and the home and do the navigating in that way, where they can both kind of show up for the children or for the baby in that way, I think that's great. If that's not possible due to safety concerns, or if there's a lot of conflicts and a lot of fighting, I think definitely having, you know, one person leave the residence. And then I think for babies, just making sure that there's, for the parents who are co-parenting together and both parents are in it, making sure that not too many days go by without the baby seeing and having time with both parents. I think really, really protecting that bond and that attachment with the baby and each parent is really critical.
Now, there's lots of debate about this, isn't there? It used to be that we used to look at Bowlby, who was kind of the father of attachment theory, and it was felt that the baby could only attach to one parent. But largely, that's kind of not really considered to be the thing at the moment, is it? There's lots of evidence that babies can attach to more than one caregiver. And so, as you say, if that is the sort of option, trying to create the attachment to both parents is really important in those early days, isn't it? And if, as you say, if it's safe and you can both be in the home so that that attachment can happen, that has to be better ultimately for the baby concerned.
Yeah, and I think sometimes it just takes getting creative. If there is an amicable relationship between both co-parents, I think it sometimes takes getting creative. How can we do this in a way if the parent is not in the home? How can we do this in a way where the parent either comes over and has a certain amount of parenting time, the other parent maybe leaves the home? Does the one parent come and pick up the child and spend a few hours with the child and then bring the child back? But I think, I mean, obviously best case scenario, if the parents are amicable and can kind of create a schedule that works for everybody, that's the best, you know, approach. And that's not always the case, unfortunately, but...
And what's the thought on overnights and things like that? Because again, that's another period of contention. Obviously, you may have breastfeeding to factor into this. You may not. But what's the thinking about whether a baby should stay in one place and the parents kind of try and rotate in and out? Or is it okay for very young babies to be moving between households? What does the research say at this point?
I think it's a case by case basis. It's a comfort level. I think it really depends on kind of the health also of each parent. So if one of the parents is struggling with their mental health, or if there's other circumstances within the home, I really think it's looking at like, where is the child going to be the safest and the most well cared for.
And if there's not a natural birth mother in the picture then, and let's say it's a different family type, are there some rules to follow still? Then is it that the baby needs to stay still and the parents need to kind of navigate around the baby rather than the baby moving? Is that, I mean, we have nesting situations now, don't we, which are all sound great, but they're quite hard and quite tough on a parent, aren't they? So what are your thoughts about that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think if at all possible, you know, for the baby to stay put in place in one home and in one place, I think that that's always the best case scenario. I think that oftentimes, again, the parents, it's a lot. It's a lot when there's a small child, when there's a baby, they have so many needs. There's so many, you know, they just need us all the time. And so I think that we need to kind of get creative and really look at what is in the best interest of the baby. So I think, yeah, having a baby in one home and the parents sort of working around that is the best approach.
And I think what you were saying before about it's really little and often, isn't it? So it's not creating a parenting schedule. You've got long gaps without, you know, the baby being able to see the other parent and so on and so forth. And, you know, the quick, the sort of small snatches of contact or seeing the child so that you've got the chance to bond over like multiple small times rather than having big, long, elongated periods where it's much more difficult.
For sure. Yeah. And again, I think these are like the ideal situations. And I know that's not always how life works, right? So, you know, obviously there's what the ideal is, and then there's what our reality is. And I think obviously when people are separating there, it's a really, really tough time. So there may be some kind of mental health issues. There may be some other things going on within the home or with each co-parent that they need to really focus on their own mental health and their own healing in order to be able to show up in the best way for their children. And
yeah. And like you were saying, it's a huge mental load, isn't it? A lot to take on when you've just had a baby, you're grieving the relationship, and then you're facing potential periods of separation from your baby. That can be absolutely catastrophically overwhelming, can't it?
Yeah, Nick, it's debilitating. I think the loss of control, and it's not meant to be that way, right? Whereas mothers, we're meant to kind of be with our children all the time. We have this innate need to protect them at all costs. And so knowing that they're going somewhere or that they're with someone who maybe we're concerned about, are they able to kind of meet the baby's needs? And I think obviously when you're separating, there's a lot of reasons that you're separating. And so just all of the feelings that go with that and the, whether there's anger, whether there's betrayal, there's, you know, even if it was the most amicable separation, I think there's always that, like, can this other co-parent provide this love and meet their emotional needs and meet their physical needs in the way that I can? And when your life kind of feels so out of control, you want to have control over your most precious, you know, people in your life. So I think that is an extremely challenging thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess from the other side as well, it's about wanting the space to be able to demonstrate that you can meet the child's needs or the baby's needs. And that can feel frustrating as well, can't it? Where, you know, you feel you're sort of examined and looked over and you want to be able to have some time alone and just to not be observed, but just to have that bonding time and to learn and to make your mistakes without feeling that they're going to be unduly criticized or that you're going to be labeled as unable to meet the baby's needs. So as the child grows and we get to sort of toddler, how does the advice change when you're sort of divorcing with toddlers? Either you're going through the process of divorce, so let's start with that, where you're actually sort of initiating the end of the relationship during a child's toddlerhood. What do we need to be aware of in those circumstances?
Yeah, I think just communicating with the child as openly as you possibly can without giving them too much information about the why and the reasons. I think oftentimes people struggle with how to, you know, if we're having conversations around what's happening in the marriage and in the separation, then the kids are going to ask a lot of questions we won't know how to answer. And so I think a lot of people make the mistake of like not really opening up to the child and explaining what's happening. And that can cause a lot of confusion. That can cause a lot of kids will act out because they're frustrated, they're concerned, they're confused, and they don't have the answer. So I think talking to your children in a way that's developmentally appropriate, giving them what they need to have it and reminding them that it's not their fault, even from a really young age, just reminding them that it's not their fault and that there's nothing they did to cause any of this, and that both parents love them deeply. And that, you know, one thing that was really important to me was making sure that my kids knew that we were still a family, even though our family looked different. And even though we had two homes and there was a lot of kind of going back and forth, that we were committed to them and we wanted to make sure that they knew they were loved and that we were still a family unit. So I think really communicating with your kids on that, I think it's really important for kids, especially in the toddler years and in school age years, to have concrete information about where they're going to be going, what they're going to be doing, what the schedule is going to look like, who's going to be picking them up from daycare. Even at a young age, I think we forget that kids really crave that consistency and that information. And when they don't have that, everything feels very chaotic to them. Everything feels very confusing. And I think that can increase the amount of kind of trauma and not knowing kind of how things are going to go. And that leaves kids feeling very anxious. So I think making sure that they're aware, like, daddy's going to pick you up at this time, mom's going to pick you up at this time. I think having a neutral kind of like routine around pickups and drop-offs is really important, so that things feel they can kind of settle into this new routine and this new experience. And I think having grace for your kids and knowing that they're going to struggle. I mean, it's a huge adjustment. Everything has changed, right? Like, their whole life, the way that they knew it before, even though they were so little, they're absorbing and they're understanding kind of things are different now and things feel different now. And they're going to be wanting control and information, and having that knowledge really gives them a sense of control.
You're right, aren't you? It's communicating the small stuff when they're toddlers, because they won't understand the word divorce or separation or those big words that older children will. And we'll come on to talk about those. But at the toddler age, they only have a few words, maybe a few sentences. So it's going to be about showing up and being consistent as much as what you say, isn't it? It's really about establishing a routine and normalizing that routine for them as quickly as possible. I get a lot of questions from families who say, well, you know, we take a really relaxed approach. We're just going to each muck in, and, you know, we both work from home, so we'll do this. And I kind of always wonder whether when they're that young, it is better to have a bit of structure and then be able to flex rather than start with no structure. And then it feels a bit chaotic from the child's perspective. Great from the parent's perspective, because we're all busy, we're all working, and I see how it fits. But from thinking about it from the child's perspective, I think that to the children prefer a little bit more structure and routine.
I completely agree. Yeah. And like you said, the structure and the kind of the way that we're doing things can always change and shift as time goes on. And as the kids reach different developmental stages, it's going to look a little bit different. You're going to kind of check in with your kids about what's working best for them, what they need. And I think the information that you share with your kids is also going to change as they grow and as they mature and as they're able to understand, you know, more of the information that you're sharing. You can share a little bit more, or obviously no details about the circumstances of the separation, but just kind of more about like, this is what our family is going to look like now. And, you know, kind of allowing them to settle in and adjust and answering their questions to the best of your ability. I think it's really important for kids to feel safe enough to ask. And if they don't feel safe enough to ask, they're going to act out and kind of show you in different ways and in different behaviors. And so I think really creating a safe space where they're able to ask questions and they're able to get reassurance and validation when they need to.
And what sort of co-parenting routines but best benefit toddlers? So they're still quite young, so still long periods away from either one parent's going to be hard for them, because they don't necessarily have quite got that concept of theory of mind yet, have they, where they can understand that just because they can't see somebody, they haven't disappeared. So they don't quite get that, do they? So what sort of patterns are you looking at that work for toddlers?
Yeah, I would say no more than 3 days away from each parent. So I think making sure that there is some time, even if it's not an overnight, but if it's some sort of contact, some sort of time with the other parent, setting it up in that way. So no more than 3 days.
Yeah. So pickups after school, taking to clubs, doing that kind of stuff, having dinner. So it doesn't have to be there. And can toddlers tolerate overnights back and forth?
Mm-hmm. I think it depends on the child. I think it really depends on the child, and every child is different. I think kind of checking in with the child about how it feels and you know, what does it feel like to be, you know, have two homes and two beds, and how does that feel, as much as they can obviously communicate. And I think it can always shift and change, and we can start out with more of like kind of the afternoons and the evenings and the pickups and drop-offs, and then kind of work our way up to overnights if that feels better. But I think, yeah, checking in with your kid and just knowing your child and kind of what feels best for them.
And I guess also your childcare arrangements as well, because if you've got a nanny or something, and whether you can get a nanny to rotate between the two homes to provide some consistency and that kind of stuff, whether you've got working at home with different parents and that kind of thing. So I guess it's there isn't a formula, I think, is what I'm trying to say. Yeah. I know it would be lovely if we could just say, this is what works for this age of child, this is what works for the other, but it really is. And I think you get the best out of it when you can have an honest conversation with your ex and steer away from this idea of 50-50 custody, because one, we don't have custody in this country, so we don't use that term, we don't have that term. We have parental responsibility, so both parents have parental responsibility.
Okay,
and then it's
I like
time
that.
time spent with their children rather than custody. So, but we do get quite obsessed with this idea of fairness and wanting to see the child equal amounts of time. And I think my overriding sort of message to people and my feeling about it, having, you know, worked with lots of families, is you need to let go of this idea that you're going to have the exact same amount of time, because it's about what your child needs and what will fit. You can't be waking your child up at some ungodly hour just to make sure you've both had your equal time. And it, do you know, and I know parents wouldn't go that far, but the principle of, right, well, you have to come to my house, even though your mum's house is right near to the soccer ground that you play soccer on, but you're coming to my house because it's my turn, and that kind of stuff is what's destructive. And just trying to sort of get the sense of, it's the quality of the time, how to make it feel normal and natural for your child, rather than sweating the minutes and the hours to make it equal. That, I think that has to be the sort of format, doesn't it?
Yeah. Are we looking at what's in the best interest of our children, and what's going to put less stress and create less chaos in their lives? Or are we looking at kind of what's in our own best interest and what's in our benefit, and kind of coming at it from a fear-driven or control kind of headspace? So I just think it's so often when we're in the co-parenting journey, it's such a good idea to just like check our intentions, check ourselves. You know, what are we doing? Because we can so often be on autopilot, right? And we're in fight or flight, and we're trying to look out for, you know, like we're trying to protect our kids, and we're just in this process and season. And I think when we get still with ourselves and really look at what are our intentions and what is in the best interest of our kids, and what can we do to kind of mitigate the circumstances of how intense and how challenging it can be for kids to kind of get through that. I think that that's just so important. And I think it's something that is really hard to do, because we're so focused on, you know, what is right, what makes sense, what we think is in the best interest, but really, is it?
It's a really good point, because, you know, I've never sat down with a parent who doesn't say, I just want what's best for the children. That's a natural thing that we say as parents, isn't it? But how you separate that desire from what gets mixed up as your own stuff, that's really hard. That's not easy for any of us to do. And it's tricky. Are there things you can do? Because I like the phrase you used before, like, let's check in and our to our true intentions. How do you do that then? What questions do you ask yourself, or how do you create that kind of true checking in? Is there a specialist? Are there a list of questions you can ask yourself? Yeah. Can you go somewhere? Can you do something? How do you get for underneath sure. that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think working with a therapist is really essential. I think that really getting to know yourself, and the best way to do that is with a therapist or a coach. I think support groups can be so huge, because you're in a room with people who have experienced so many similar things that you're going through. And so I think it's really a space where we can get quiet with ourselves and support each other in a way. And I think, yeah. So I think the questions that you ask, I mean, I think just always pausing, like when you start to feel, I mean, I always tell clients to kind of get in touch with their bodies, like what's happening inside their bodies in the moment. And I think during conversations with co-parents and kind of trying to figure out the plan and the schedule, and if there is, you know, a custody battle or a parenting situation happening, you know, what's going on in your body? Because I think so often we do kind of function in this state of fight or flight, where we're not able to make like the most rational decisions. We're not really in our bodies. We are in fight or flight, and we think, you know, we're very honed in and kind of tunnel vision on what we think the best thing is. And I think when we can get quiet with ourselves and really look at what our intentions are, and also look at like, okay, like what is it that my child might need? And maybe my child needs more time with their other parent right now. And maybe that's going to be hard for me. That's going to make me feel lonely. I'm going to feel sad about that. I'm going to be fearful that they might connect more with that parent, and they might love that parent more in this moment. And that might be a big fear for me. And it also might be best. And so I think learning kind of those self-soothing techniques where we can pause and say, like, we're going to like kind of comforting ourselves, and we're going to be okay, and our child is going to be okay. And we just have to really lean into our intuition around like what our kids need.
I like that, learning to self-soothe, because if you can self-soothe, you're open to more creative solutions, which is something you said at the beginning, which I really like, which is like, how can we get creative here? Let's move on to the children who are sort of school age. So now we're sort of moving on to children who you are probably going to have to tell that you are separating, divorcing, whichever kind of word you're going to use, but what are the sort of golden rules for that age of child? So they've got a school routine set up, they're, you know, cognitively at a point where they can understand separation. What sort of things are we doing and saying for these children?
Yeah, I think this age is tricky because sometimes our kids will kind of throw questions at us that we're not totally prepared to answer, right? So I think, you know, there's been many times where I've had to say, you know what, like, that's a really good question. And let me think more on that. And we can talk more about that after dinner. Or let's, because I think so often, we can be triggered even by our kids' questions, right? Or they try to test us, they try to kind of dig in. They ask a question that maybe they know they're just looking for more information, because information, again, is power. It's control. It's like a sense of like, okay, if I can know what's happening here, then I know what to expect. And then my anxiety is going to decrease. So I think it's natural for kids to do that. And I think we can kind of be, ooh, like, what I want to say right now maybe isn't what I should say right now. So let me pause, let me take a moment, and then let's come back to it. You know, we don't want our kids to feel like they're not getting answers from us. We want to always come back and be like, let's have this conversation. I know you asked a really good question. I kind of want to know what was going on for you when you asked that question. Let's talk about what came up today for you. I think so often kids start to realize that maybe their families look a little different than their friends' families. And they start to, ooh, like my best friend, she gets to go on vacation with both of her parents and I don't get to do that. And so that feels different. That makes me, you know, feel sad, or I feel left out, or I, you know, so many different things. So I think really coming to like keeping that open communication and like what came up for you today, kind of where was that coming from, and letting them. I think so often as parents too, we want to fix it. We just want them to feel better, right? We don't want our kids to feel pain. We don't want them to feel scared. We want them to feel like they belong and they fit in. And so we just want to fix it. And we want it the quickest way to do that. We want to fix it. And I think so often kids need to feel safe and like there's space for them to just feel their feelings and that it's okay to feel those feelings. And there's no shame around those feelings. And so I think when we can create a space where they feel comfortable and safe coming and asking those really hard questions and knowing that they're going to be met with a parent who's going to say like, wow, yeah, like that is really hard. And it's really, that had to be really hard to hear about, you know, your best friend's vacation with both her parents. And it probably made you, you know, sad that you didn't have both your parents, and sort of like empathizing and validating, and then explaining that, you know, our life, there are benefits to both, right? Like you know, not in a way that we're sort of dismissing them, but in a way where we can talk about, okay, yeah, but we can also go on a vacation. We can do really fun things. And then you might get to have two vacations. I just think the safety and the ability to kind of create that space. And if you need to pause as the parent, if you need to take a minute and say, I'm not prepared to answer this right now. It's a great question. Let's come back to it. I think always do that. I think those knee-jerk responses where we sort of respond in a way that maybe we feel like we need to defend ourselves, or we need to, you know, like make sure that they know that, you know, it wasn't our fault and, you know, it wasn't our decision. And so I think making sure that we are in a good headspace, we are regulated, we are grounded when we're answering those questions. And I think also another thing to keep in mind is kids so often come back from their other parent's house. And I think it's in our nature to want to know what happened there and what did you guys do and what did you talk about and who was there. And in a way that we want to be involved, right? It's hard to know that our kids are away from us for a period of time and we don't feel involved. And it can be lonely. It can be anxiety provoking. It can be all these things. And so I think we want to flood them with like all these questions and what did you do and how was it? And did you feel sad? Did you feel happy? And I think really being mindful of that and knowing that like when they come back, they may need a little bit of grace period. And they also, it puts them in a really difficult position where they want to say the right thing, right? They want to make sure that they're not going to say something that's going to hurt one parent or the other parent. They want to be very careful. And I think that hypervigilance can create more anxiety for them where they feel like they have to say and behave a certain way at each parent's home. And that's really stressful on children.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? I think when mine come back, they need a little bit of just time without anybody saying anything in order to just
kind of, yeah, transition.
Decompress. Like, yeah. Get back into their other routine. And it's, yeah, I agree. The temptation is to want to know because you know everything else about their lives when they're kids, don't you? You're used to grilling them when they come home from school even. And I've learned even not to do that because apparently that really annoys them. And when we get to this kind of age, when they're school age, what sort of patterns of spending time with each parent work for this group of children?
Yeah, I think at this school age, I think, again, depending on the child, I think it's different for everybody. But I think up in, you know, close to a week, I would say like 5 to 7 days, they might be, as they get a little bit older, as they kind of approach middle school, I think that that's appropriate, depending on kind of how the kids have adjusted kind of their relationship with both parents. So I think kind of a schedule that works for everybody. But yeah, between, you know, some people do 1 week on, 1 week off, some people do kind of a 5-2-2-5 kind of thing.
That a lot over here. 2-2-5-5. Okay. Five. Yeah. Monday, Tuesday with one parent, Wednesday, Thursday the other, and then you rotate Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So that bleeds into the next week to give you a 5 period. And then yeah, it's quite a good one for children at school, because then always Monday and Tuesday you're in the same parent's house, always Wednesday and Thursday. So it helps them create the routine. And if you've got clubs or things, you know that when you've got swimming club, it's always going from dad's house. When you've got football, it's always going from mum's house, and that kind of stuff. And then it works, doesn't it?
Yes, so I think absolutely.
That can help them with a sense of routine and normality. And when we're talking to children about the separation, this group, as you say, they're going to ask lots of questions, aren't they? This group particularly, or potentially, not all children ask lots of questions. Sometimes the hardest thing for some parents is that their kids don't ask any questions. They're just like, oh, they've got so prepared to do the big announcement. And then the kids just sit there and go, okay. And then they go on. But I think part of this is to have the conversation several times, isn't it? And to keep it just listening to them and answering the questions. And I loved what you said there about, because don't we all feel on the spot when we're asked a question, you feel compelled to answer, but just creating that space by saying, that's a really great question. I need to think about how I'm going to answer that. And then just, you know, coming back to them, that's just gold dust. You know, that's a great technique to use to buy yourself some time, certainly. And just to get yourself into the headspace where if you need to, you can discuss it, how you're going to answer that question with your other co-parent. If it's something that you need to address on your own, then you can. But I love the buying the time. Is there a sort of a formula for how you tell children? You mentioned making sure that your children know that they're loved and that kind of stuff, and it's not their fault for the younger group. I'm guessing it's the same for these school age children. Is there anything else that's important when you tell them about the divorce or separation?
Yeah, I think being clear about what it's going to look like. I think getting on the same page as your co-parent so that you guys are a united front when you're talking to the children is, if at all possible. I know that's not always possible, but I think if it's possible to kind of everybody sit down together and create a space where, and you're right, the kids may not have questions right then and there, but allowing them to know that they can ask any questions as the questions arise. And I think as the kids sort of process all of it and things start to look and feel different, because in the beginning they may be like, okay, this is fine. This is great. Like, oh yeah, we have two houses and that's fine. It's no big deal. But then as things sort of progress, it might feel different, and it might feel scary, and it might feel lonely, and it might feel confusing. So kind of allowing that space for them to ask questions as they go. I really love the idea of kind of having family meetings or having meetings, regular contact with your co-parent, if it's safe, if it's okay, you know, if it's a healthy co-parenting relationship, and just getting on the same page about, you know, Johnny was asking me, you know, he was over here, you know, over the past weekend, and he was asking me questions about, you know, why we aren't living together, and he wants, you know, Santa to, you know, all he wants is his family back together for Christmas or things like that, and kind of communicating with the other co-parent so that the other co-parent can kind of be more in tune and more present for those questions. And if something were to come up, just, I think it's so important to be on the same page, communicating about your child's emotional needs and what their questions might be, so that when they're with the other parent, like, we can kind of step in and just be aware. And if it warrants a conversation, if it, you know, hey, do you have any questions? Or I heard that you were feeling a little bit sad last weekend at dad's house. Do you want to talk about it? I think that that's just so important. And I think being aware of our, you know, communication with the co-parent in front of the children. I think, you know, one thing that my ex and I did, which it was challenging, but we made an agreement that we were never, as much as possible, we were never going to like talk badly about the other person. And I really think we both have honored that.
Well, kids by this age are going to be realizing that they're part of both of their parents, aren't they? So they're at that stage, if they're at school, where they're going to understand that they are the sum of the two parts. And therefore, to badmouth one parent is to denigrate a part of that child. And that's really important to kind of hold on to. If you are badmouthing the parent, it's going to hurt that child. So you have to find a way of dealing with how you feel about the other parent that doesn't involve your children. And whether that, like you said earlier, therapy and having a therapist walking alongside this journey is absolutely, or whether it's a group or whether it's journaling, whatever your chosen method, it's you have to be able to remove that from your child.
For sure. Yeah. And even just being aware of like the nonverbal communication, I think is huge and something that we're not always aware of, right? So we're like, oh, well, we never said anything bad about our co-parent. We always support that person, but it's our nonverbal communication, I think, that really kids pick up on, right? They're so in tune with our energy and they're so in tune with us. And so they immediately, their senses are heightened. Oh, they mom's energy is shifting. She just had a conversation with dad, or dad's energy is shifting. He's frustrated with mom. And obviously we're not perfect. We are human beings and we're going to get dysregulated. We're going to feel frustrated. We're going to, occasionally roll our eyes, or our tone's going to change, or it happens. We're human beings. But I think just, again, being aware of like, okay, like do I need to take a minute so that I'm not huffing and puffing and heavy sighing and rolling my eyes around this, my co-parent, like, do I need to take a break and then go sort of regulate myself and then come back to the situation? Because I do think kids pick up so much on that nonverbal communication as well. And that's something that we don't always, we're like, well, I haven't said anything bad about him, but what is my energy? My energy is like giving off a different vibe. So
let's move on to teenagers then, the tricky lot. So if you're divorcing or separating and you've got teens, what's different? So we won't cover the same ground, because some of these messages will be the same. Kids of any age need to know they're loved and need to know the details of what's going to happen. But I guess when you get to teenagers, you're co-creating sometimes rather than dictating what a schedule or whatever it's going to look like. So what are the key things to watch for with teens?
Yeah, I think consistency between the homes is really, really important. So I think as kids kind of approach the teenage years, they're kind of looking for, what can I get away with at one parent's home versus the other parent's home? And okay, when I'm at dad's, I can do A, B, and C. Or when I'm at mom's, I'm allowed to do this, but I'm not allowed to do this at dad's house. And so I think really just those conversations with your co-parent about like, how do we feel about this? And what are the rules of the home? And what are the consequences if those rules are broken? And I think just, for me, I think continuing to have family meetings, which can sometimes be uncomfortable if you don't have a very good relationship with your co-parent, but I think it just sends a message that like, yes, we aren't living together and we have two separate homes, but we are still together co-parenting. We want what's best for you. And we want to show you that we love you and we are going to be, there are going to be consequences to whatever's happening. So I think really ensuring that that's the case. I think it's really hard with teenagers because I think at that point, teenagers, they want to do what they want to do. And so if there's more leniency at one parent's house versus another, they're going to want to spend more time over there. And so I think, being on the same page is super key. I think in terms of parenting time, I think typically 2 weeks, some people can go up to 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. I think sometimes that can be really hard. But I think anywhere between a week on, week off, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off can be inappropriate, but no longer than that.
And where do you stand on letting, ultimately, I suppose when they're 15, 16, they are going to vote with their feet. You can't stop, can you, a 15 or 16 year old physically leaving the house? It just doesn't work. So ultimately they will vote with their feet. So the only power you've got is soft power by that point, isn't it? In terms of trying to do the consistency and agreeing on boundaries and consequences. But like you say, they're going to want to be involved. They're going to some extent dictate. But I guess some of this is about how you as an adult want to navigate that journey yourself. And you might not get the outcome you want, but if you're being true and authentic, if you are, the one who does feel there should be consequences or there shouldn't be PS4 or whatever being played till midnight, and you need to stick to that boundary for yourself because that's what you believe, then you do that. And if the consequence of that is they spend more time with the other parent, then is that okay? To me, that feels a better way around than, letting all your own boundaries go out the window in order to crave the equal amount of time, because that feels like you're teaching something not
for
right
sure.
there at that
yeah,
point.
Yeah, I agree. 100% agree. Yeah.
You sort of got to have your own contract with yourself as well as with your child, haven't you? And you have to accept some of the consequences that like you say, a teenager will go to where they can get away with the more lenient lifestyle. And
for sure, right?
You got to, I guess, yeah, you just have to come to terms with that as a parent of a teenager, ultimately, ooh, don't you?
It's tough, right? Yeah, it's tough. And I think, yeah, just kind of remembering that we're not here to be their friend. We're here to guide them and direct them and be, you know, the constant force of, you know, wanting what's best for them. And that can be tricky. That can be hard, especially I think when you are, you know, there's you're in a co-parenting dynamic and they have two homes and they have, you know, it's easy to want to give in and sort of overcompensate, and because you want that relationship with them, you don't want them to spend more time at the other parent's house. And I agree with you, not kind of negotiating on your own boundaries, and cause that sends a message as well. Yeah.
Cause it's hard enough when you're parenting, not co-parenting, but parenting a teenager anyway, you can have different ideas as parents and how you then navigate that within the family. That's hard enough, let alone you potentially not getting on with the other parent you're supposed to be co-parenting with. That just adds another dimension. And teenagers will punish you. There is no question about it. They know how to press your buttons. They know how to be very cruel, and they will punish you to get what they want. And that's part of their brain development. They're very black and white. Everything's very dramatic. So it is just a bit of it's a tightrope to go through this stuff with teenagers. But I think that I think knowing your own boundaries and knowing yourself and what is your parenting style and what your boundaries, I think that's absolutely critical to navigating this with a teenager, because ultimately you can only control the things you can control. You can't control them and you can't control the other parent. So if you can't agree, you have to learn to deal with what you're working with and not what you wish you were working with, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think so often, you know, we in the moment, it feels like, you know, it's so many different, this can go for so many different, you know, circumstances, but in the moment when you're parenting teenagers, it feels so overwhelming and you question, am I doing a good job? And, you know, do they hate me? And, you know, so many different things. And I think when you're just steadfast in doing what's best for your child, eventually they'll look back when they're in their 20s or whatever age it is and kind of, you know, be grateful for that steadfast, you know, parent who was, you know, I'm not going to negotiate on my boundaries. This is it. And this is what we're doing. And here are the consequences when we don't do these things. And so I think it does pay off, you know, not always in the moment, but down the road. So
I absolutely agree. That's the thing. I think when you're parenting teens, you're doing it for the long term, for who they're going to turn into, not for the immediate payback, which you do get with younger kids, don't you? Well-behaved and all of that kind of stuff. That's not what you get in the teen years. And you are parenting effectively for the future and their future selves. And you're right. I think it's only later in life, perhaps when she said, hopefully they come back and recognize that you were the one with the boundaries.
We hope so, right?
Yeah. Clinging on to that, Julie, I'm clinging on to that. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And I know I'm conscious of time, but we've talked about these groups of children as if they are not interdependent. Obviously in a family, you could have a children in all of those categories at the same time. So your whole parenting kind of mix, you're having to juggle younger children and older children and trying to potentially give slightly different messages to younger and older children and slightly different schedules even sometimes. So this can be a really complicated area. And yet, as we started in this conversation, it feels there isn't a lot of information out there to navigate. So where can people go? Because we've literally scratched the surface. Where can people go to find out more about what works, what doesn't work, the pitfalls and everything else?
Yeah, I think looking into a therapist that specializes in, you know, working with children and families of divorce is so key. I think for myself, my daughter was 4 when we separated. And right away, I kind of was like, I want her to have that, you know, that support. And in the beginning, I was like, it's for her. You know, my son was a baby. But in the beginning, I'm like, oh, it's for her. But then as time went on, I'm like, it's actually for all of us as a family. And so her dad would join us in the sessions as well. And I think that looking back, like that was so powerful for her to see us both coming to these sessions and showing up and talking through things and allowing her to share her feelings in the session. And we're both there to listen at the same time. And I think that's so powerful. And I think in those, getting the support early on for the kids is so huge, and for yourself. I think it just makes such a difference. And it just really sets the tone of like, yes, this is tragic and it can be really, really hard. And it can also be a really beautiful experience where we can come together and kind of, and go through this journey together. So I think reaching out and looking into who in your area may specialize in working with children and families of divorce, support groups are so huge. I think it's just such, the group process and the group dynamic is so powerful because we feel less alone. We feel like there are other people who understand, and maybe we're isolated in our own life and we don't have a lot of people in our lives who have been through the same experiences, but kind of reaching out to those people that that have been through it and kind of working on things together, I think is so key.
And where can people find out more about you, Julie? So if people are interested in hearing more about your work and what you do and sort of your more of your tips, because we've, like I say, we've scratched the surface. We've not even gone near blended families or anything like that yet, have we? But, or adult children, you know, when, because obviously it affects all children, even if they've grown up and got their own lives. So where can people find out more about you?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram at mindful_co-parenting.
Well, that's great. And you can find me, I'm on X, I'm at @Kate_daily. You can hear about new podcast episodes by subscribing for updates and visiting thedivorcepodcast.com or on your favorite listening platforms as well. So it just remains for me to say, Julie, massive thanks for joining me today. It's been really fascinating having a good run through the different ages and stages and how divorce impacts children. And thank you very much, everybody else, for listening.
Thank you so much.